It gives me the very greatest of pleasure to welcome this week to Cry Freedom Radio, Andrew Johnson, a well-known and respected analytical and technical researcher out there in the so-called truth world. And I have mentioned the numerous areas of interest that Andrew's work covers just previously, an extensive list that you can actually find on Andrew's website at checktheevidence.com. So I'd just like to say a very warm hello to Andrew. Fantastic to finally talk to you. And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Lisa. Thanks for inviting me to come on to your programme.
Absolute pleasure, and I'm so glad that you could actually do that. Well, a great many of the listeners will actually be familiar with who you are and the work that you do, and we will touch on all of that shortly, but I just thought it would be really good if you could start off by giving us a little bit of background about yourself, essentially how this all started for you, and a bit about your journey, because I don't think this is something that people necessarily usually do here, and I think it would be good for us to hear that. You are a Yorkshire lad, and you do describe yourself as someone who's honest and tries to be balanced and dislikes conflict, and I think most of those that know you or follow you would agree that that's where you actually do come from. So if you want to go ahead with that and just tell us a bit about yourself, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of strange in that I've said to all the people that I seem to have like a dual life. You know, it's like I've got a dual identity, because I've got a fairly ordinary domestic situation. You know, we live in sort of a semi-detached house in Derbyshire in a place called Borrowash and things like that. You know, and I have two teenage children that go to, you know, school and everything. And I've lived in this house for, you know, quite a few years now, about, I think, 17 years, I think it is now. So, you know, and I've had a sort of stable background in that time, you know, a stable situation.
Yeah.
And I grew up, you know, in a sort of Yorkshire town, and we didn't have a lot of money. We weren't destitute, but we didn't have a lot of money for doing things. So I grew up in that environment with, you know, older brothers and sisters around me. And I went to a grammar school, and went through that sort of system. And then, you know, in these days, a lot of people think that there's a lot of problems with that. And I think that's true. But at the same time, if you go through a formal education, there are certain things which it can give you, providing you can maintain your curiosity and your, you know, your balance in terms of not just believing absolutely everything that you know you're told.
Exactly.
I feel I was given a good educational framework. For example, given the ability to solve mathematical problems, you know, looking at the world and observing, performing experiments in physics and chemistry, you know, gathering data, that sort of thing. Those skills can be acquired as part of a formal education, and then you can apply those in just the same way, you know, as you can to the regular experiments that you're given. To the fields of alternative knowledge, and that's essentially, if people go onto my website, what they'll find. And I essentially started that process, as I've told this story quite a few times, back in about 2003. Really, I mean, I've had a lifelong interest in, you know, paranormal phenomena and UFOs and you know, all the things which you don't really get taught about at school. You might do them in an afternoon, you know, for some sort of, I mean, I did my general studies A-level project on UFOs, on the UFO issue.
All right.
And I did a sort of, you know, whatever it was, 3 or 4,000 word project. I don't know how many thousand words it was. I think it was about 20 pages. So it was probably about 8,000 words on the UFO issue. And that was, you know, back in 1982, 83 sort of time. And that's when I met Tony Dodd, the famous UFO investigator who's now no longer with us. And he was working in the Yorkshire Police Force. He actually lived in Skipton.
All right.
That when I was 17, 18. And my English teacher knew him.
Huh.
And so he arranged for me to go and see Tony. And I went to see him a couple of evenings and chatted to him for a couple of hours each evening, I think. And he gave me some literature which I used for my project.
As a policeman, how did he sort of get into the field of the UFO field? Because
It was through his own sightings and experience.
Right.
He related this experience to me. I think he wrote about this as well. that he was on the beat one night and he'd seen these lights going over, you know.
Wow. And, this is fascinating with me. You know, can I just, sorry to interrupt you, I actually know an ex-policeman who's a friend, and he's had exactly the same experience. He saw these fireball objects that were so not anything natural. And it was in the night when he was on the beat in the night. Wow.
Right, yeah, and similar thing with Tony Dodd, I think, as far as, you know, I can remember him telling me. And what he did was he had a torch one time, and he started signalling to this craft, and it signalled back at him, you know. I distinctly remember him telling me that story, and I think this had happened on more than one occasion. I think this was, I'm trying to remember, I think this was Carlton Moor, which was quite near to where I lived.
Right.
Or it might have been near Ilkley Moor. It's one of those two, as I recall. But, I mean, we're going back over 30 years in my memory. I don't think I wrote this down. So I'd had that interest. I saw a documentary, 2003, about the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Sure.
And I wanted to get a bit more information about that. And so I went online, and I just got the broadband internet here in my... know, sort of on our housing estate, we'd just got the NTL, as it was then. It's now Virgin Media, of course. We just got their broadband service in, and always on internet. Wow, you know, fantastic. Downloaded loads of stuff, you know, watched the Disclosure Project press conference. What the hell is this? Never heard of this. It's 2 years old. There's a cover-up. You know, there must be a cover-up because this was such a significant event. I'd heard nothing about it. And so at that point, I knew there was a cover-up of the UFO issue. It was no longer a debating point whether something was being covered up. It was totally clear to me that it was.
Yeah.
And I knew that it was important, and I knew that it was connected to the energy issue, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit.
Sure.
And I'd already... One of the first things, you know, a few years prior to this, going back to, say, sort of 96, 97 time frame, one of the first things that I did a web search for was cold fusion, which was an energy phenomenon. And I remember, I'd found all these articles, and I printed them out because, you know, in those days, if you stayed connected, you had to pay more money.
The good old days.
That's right. So, you know, you'd log onto a page, save it or print it out, and then log off, you know, and save your phone bill, of course. And that's what I did. So, you know, cold fusion was one of the first things that I searched for information for, because I was always interested in that, wondered what happened to it.
Can you explain a little bit about what that is for people that don't know?
Sure. Well, cold fusion is an energy phenomenon which was discovered in the late 80s by two chemists, Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann, and they were working on stuff at the University of Utah in the States, and they were doing, it was basically what's called an electrolysis experiment. Electrolysis, you know, anyone can do electrolysis themselves. What you do is get a jar of salt water,
yeah.
You get two razor blades, two wires, connect them to a 9-volt battery, And you'll see these little bubbles coming in the salt water, and that's electrolysis. And you'll get hydrogen on one razor blade, and you'll get chlorine comes out on the other one,
right.
Or you get some chlorine compounds.
So it's essentially a transference of energy through water, yeah? Is that right?
Well, electrolysis means breakdown by electricity. So you're using an electrical current from the battery to break down the salt water, that sodium chloride, into hydrogen, which comes out of the water. And I think you do get some chlorine gas coming off the other electrode, which I think then reacts to form other compounds immediately it comes off.
Right.
So it's basically using electrical energy to break down a solution into other molecules and atoms, which then form into other molecules. And the Pons and Fleischmann's experiment was a version of that, really. But what they found is if they used a solution of lithium hydroxide, and instead of using normal water, they used what's called heavy water, which is deuterium oxide, D2O. That has an extra neutron in the nucleus. And they found that if they used that arrangement, and I think it was a palladium electrode rather than like a, you know, an iron or a copper or a steel electrode, and they used a certain type of current with, you know, certain other conditions set up, they would get the situation where they'd get more energy coming out of the glass beaker in terms of heat than they were putting in as electric current.
Is this the over-unity thing, yeah?
Essentially, they were getting an effect. They didn't call it that then. And so what they thought might have been happening initially is that some type of nuclear reaction was occurring possibly within the electrode. Mm. And under certain circumstances, this thing would glow. And you're getting this anomalous energy, and but it wouldn't happen all the time. You know, they could have an identical setup. They could, you know, run this experiment, the exact same experiment with the exact same arrangement. You know, they could run it 10 times, and one or two times they would see this anomalous heat, this excess heat, as it was called. And the other eight times it would just be nothing. They'd just get the normal gases given off.
Right.
And that sort of thing.
How was that explained then?
Well, they didn't have an explanation for it, and the explanation still is not really clear. There's various explanations have been put forward. I mean, there's a work of a particular person that comes to mind, Ken Shoulders. He'd investigated some of the cold fusion experiments and thought it was to do with something called charge clusters. But I don't know how to explain it. What happened was there was this enormous sort of attack on Pons and Fleischmann saying, oh, yeah, they were just bad scientists. You know, they clearly hadn't set up their experimental cell properly. And this excess heat was just that they'd done the experiment incorrectly, you know, and all this sort of nonsense that went on.
Yeah.
And that went on for a couple of years before it was claimed that they were, you know, either, you hear various claims, they were either just bad scientists or they were actually, you know, fraudulent. You know, they're actually committing fraud by claiming something that wasn't true, you know, and they were trying to get experimental funds or they were trying to get things patented to make money. You know, all these claims were leveled at them. But it was often overlooked that people like John Bockris, and you know that presentation that you came to a couple of years ago, I'm pretty sure I will have played the clip of John Bockris, who was at Texas A&M University. I think at the time he was 69 years old, so he was past retirement age.
Yeah.
You know, and as he said in that clip, he's passed on now. As has Martin Fleischmann, they're both no longer with us.
All right.
John Bockris, he and a couple of other guys, they were reproduced Pons and Fleischmann's experiments, and he said that initially they didn't get anything, but then again they could get it so that about one in every four runs of their cells they would get these anomalous effects, the excess heat, and they would also get something called transmutation.
Right.
And this is a no-no in physics and chemistry. It's where one element changes into another. For example, they'd run a cell, you know, which just had a palladium electrode, palladium electrodes, and this lithium hydroxide solution. And then after they'd run the experiment, they would find copper and zinc inside the cell.
Right. This kind of touches on what we're going to talk about later, the work I think of John Hutchinson as well. Yeah.
Correct. So. You know, I'm glad you've looked into this and researched it. So this idea where you've got new elements being created, you know, this is what the alchemists claim to be able to do, you know, turning lead into gold and all of this.
Yeah.
And of course, that's just regarded as magic and mythology. You know, it's not possible in real science. And anyone that talks about such things in physics or chemistry is a quack, you know. That's,
same old stuff,
that's,
yeah.
It's the same mentality in the mainstream, which, you know, going back to what I said earlier on, if you go through the mainstream education system and you get this straight-jacketed thinking imposed upon you, you're then trained to ignore anything like that comes up, you know.
So much for open minds, hey?
Yeah, exactly. So much for inquiring minds and, you know, investigating nature and science for anomalies and explaining them. You know, that kind of all goes out the window.
Indeed.
In certain areas, you know, that you're not allowed to have evidence about.
Exactly. So since we've touched on John Hutchinson, I might as well just say one of the things that really fascinated me about what you said about him at that talk was the fact that he managed to levitate metal. I thought that was absolutely Wow.
Right. Well, he's levitated other objects as well, and this is another of these effects, which, again, put that into a laboratory, you know, university laboratory, and they'll try and debunk it, you know, or they'll try and say it hasn't happened. You know, I can talk a little bit more about that specifically. But just finishing off the John Bockris thing, so he, you know, he basically had found these effects. He agreed with Pons and Fleischmann. He supported them. And then the university that he worked for, which is Texas A&M, launched an investigation into him, which lasted 11 months, and they wanted to get rid of him. But the panel that started this investigation found that he hadn't done anything wrong. You know, he was doing basic research. He hadn't misappropriated any funds or anything like that. And he was exonerated, you know. And I think, again, they actually had two runs at him. The first one, he was exonerated, and then they started it all again about 6 months later, and he was exonerated again.
Right, you know. Right. And it has to beg the question to anybody listening that, you know, why was he attacked in this way by the university? You know, that's got to be the question, hasn't it?
It has, absolutely. And there are a number of other scientists that got involved as well. I think some of them tried to rock the boat more than others. But, you know, if people go on, you'll find people on the internet who'll say that, you know, Pons and Fleischmann's experiments have never been reproduced. That is a lie, because, you know, John Bockris reproduced them. There was a guy in Japan, he wrote a book about his experiments and what he'd found out. And I forget the name of the guy, I always forget it because it's quite difficult to pronounce. He also reproduced some of the effects. And Michael McCoubrey, who worked for Stanford Research Institute, he also reproduced certain effects as well. But it's essentially been left on the shelf, this phenomenon. And then one of the other people that I always mention in when I'm asked to talk about this is Steve Nee Jones, the physicist from Brigham Young University.
Right.
And he had been doing cold fusion related research in the mid 1980s. Some people have claimed that he discovered this effect before Pons and Fleischmann. Well, actually, that's not really true, because Pons and Fleischmann had been working for 5 years before they announced their discoveries in 1989. And in fact, experiments had been done in the 1930s, you know, along similar lines. So Stephen E. Jones actually coined the term cold fusion. And it's a term that Pons and Fleischmann did not like, because they thought it was kind of like a, you know, a jokey term. And what it meant was, They thought initially they were seeing nuclear reactions, and this should not happen anywhere outside of a nuclear reactor, which is very, very hot and uses special materials, you know, uranium 235, and or you'll see it in a hot fusion reactor, which hasn't really been built yet, not really. And so to have this happening at room temperature on a you know, tabletop was seen as ridiculous. And Jones kind of coined this term with his friend Paul Palmer, and they thought, well, it's silly to call it that, because that's, you know, and they wanted to call it something like low energy nuclear reactions. That was a far more scientific sort of description of what appeared to be happening.
Sure. And I think you were sort of touching here a little bit on the fact that there are so many people out there in the so-called technical field that once they come upon an opinion of their own, they're so loath to go anything else that might turn up that might slightly be different or et cetera. They're so loath to, because of ego or whatever, to actually accept that in any way. And they'll stick to glue to what they've originally said.
Yes, I think particularly if that overturns sort of certain you know, sets of theories, I think there was considerable consternation that these two chemists, you know, Pons and Fleischmann, were challenging certain basic assumptions of physics, you know.
And
I think John Bockris actually says in this interview that he did in 1999 that they were breaking the laws of physics, you know, and he smiles when he says it, you know, because he was a chemist, you know.
It's the open mind thing yet again, isn't it?
Yeah. But he was an honest guy, you know, he was an honest guy doing honest scientific research, and he was attacked for doing that, which, of course, you know, happens a lot more than it should, put it that way.
Sure.
So, you know, we'll go on to the John Hutchison thing, which you'd mentioned earlier on, because why I'm mentioning Stephen E. Jones is he first came to my attention not for cold fusion research, but for 9/11 research.
Of course, yes.
And that was in 2005.
Yes.
When he came out, I think it was August 2005, when he came out and said, well, I don't believe the official story of the destruction of the World Trade Center, and I think somebody put thermite compounds into the buildings along with some other explosives, and that's what they used to, you know, dissolve, to cut the steel, and that's what was used, you know, and it wasn't planes crashing that caused the towers to collapse. And that was the first time I'd heard this guy's name. It was 2005 in relation to 9/11 research. And he, that is Stephen E. Jones, invited me by email, along with Jim Fetzer, to join this group that they were forming, which was called Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
Right.
And I was regarded as a scholar because I work for the Open University, which I still do. It's only a part-time role. It's a kind of a lowly academic role, so to speak, but I do, you know, tutor students in a science related subject at a UK university, albeit correspondence courses. I do occasional face to face tutorials, you know, like lectures, if you will, with students who are on an academic higher education course.
Nice.
And actually I'll be doing one tomorrow. That I got invited into this group and read this Stephen E. Jones's allegedly scientific paper about the destruction of the World Trade Center, which he called Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Towers Collapse? When I first got into that, you know, I thought, well, I was great. You know, we've got these academics, these university professors. You know, I'm just a lowly sort of associate lecturer. They're professors and doctors and so forth. That's fantastic that they're willing to, you know, nail their colours to the mast, so to speak, and talk about 9/11 and why the official story is untrue.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. And I didn't really see anything, you know, untoward, as it were, about what was going on. I couldn't see any sort of negative sides to this initially. Soon after that, I noticed there was some criticism of this Jones character because, and we will come on to John Hutchison because he will come into this story in a few minutes. Jones, you know, and his paper was getting quite a lot of promotion and people were saying, oh yeah, this is brilliant. But there were a few people saying, well, this isn't quite right because actually, the towers, you know, didn't really seem to undergo the use of thermite. You know, there was no sort of large amounts of flames.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of didn't really, that didn't register with me at first. I was kind of a bit bamboozled by this Jones, you know, physics professor.
Yeah.
Coming out and being skeptical of the official story. To me, initially, that was kind of the main thing of importance, and I suppose I wasn't really listening as closely as I should have been to what he was saying, you know, what he was actually saying. And anyway, he asked me to help, he asked for help in making this video clip about the destruction of the towers.
Right.
And what he wanted someone to do was get two video clips from two different websites and splice them together for a talk that he was doing, which allegedly showed this thermite being used with this molten metal coming out of the side of the tower.
Right.
And that was his proof, you see, of thermite being used. And I volunteered to make that video clip for him, you know, and he accepted. He didn't ask me specifically, but I volunteered and he accepted it.
Okay.
And he used it. And then a couple of months after that, I think 3 or 4 months, my name was mentioned in an article by Dr. Morgan Reynolds and Dr. Judy Wood, which they'd entitled, or ultimately entitled, Why Did the World Trade Center Towers Completely Disintegrate? Which, of course, was different to Jones's title of saying collapse.
Indeed.
And it was at that time. That Dr. Judy Wood was pointing out the towers didn't collapse. They did not collapse. they actually turn to dust before they hit the ground.
Is this the free fall facet tower collapse thing that she came up with? Yeah.
Initially it was the billiard ball example, which she showed. She used that to show that, you know, what you saw in terms of the destruction of the towers could not be explained by, you know, the building being cut into chunks and falling to the ground. That wasn't going to work as an explanation for, you know, whether it was done by planes or, you know, bombs or whatever it was. She was showing with that billiard ball example, and it wasn't a model, it was just an example. A model is different to an example. It was just a vaguely similar scenario that she was, you know, using the timing of to illustrate that the towers did not collapse.
Andrew, what was the relevance of this delayed fireball on the second tower that I've briefly read about?
Yeah, well, that was. We'll get onto that in a minute.
Oh, sure.
Maybe.
Yeah, sure.
That's related to what we're talking about.
Okay.
It's just on a slightly different sort of thread. But so what happened was, Dr. Judy Wood, she'd pointed out that the towers had turned to dust, and I began to realise that that she was right in late 2006, and then. I found out that Jones had been involved in cold fusion research. I think I found that out in early 2007 or around about that time. And that's the first time for me in my mind, you know, I've already talked about earlier on how I'd established the connection between the UFO issue and the energy issue. In fact, I didn't establish that. That was done for me in my mind by Stephen Greer in his disclosure project. And then we have the link between 9/11 and energy because of Stephen E. Jones, who was claiming the towers, you know, were destroyed using thermite, or at least partly using thermite. And this was when you started to study this, as Dr. Judy Wood had, it was clearly ridiculous. What Jones said was ridiculous. And, you know, I realized I'd been fooled and I'd been a bit stupid. And I think then I began to realize that if I was, you know, being that stupid, then why wasn't Jones willing to say, oh, yeah, it can't be what I said it was. It must be something else.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
He would not admit that the towers turned to dust, which is what happened.
Okay. Am I right in thinking that one of the bones of contention was that the liquid that was seen coming out, the liquid metal, some people were saying that could only be iron and there couldn't be any aluminium because apparently when aluminium is molten, it's silvery in colour, not orange. But this is something that's been proven not to be entirely true. And is that something that Dr. Wood was working on?
Exactly. You've touched on a very, very important point. You know, I'm glad that you brought that up because that is one of the sort of, that is essentially where we caught Jones in a lie because he'd claimed that molten aluminium was silvery at all temperatures in daylight conditions. And this is not true. If you melt aluminium, you know, to its melting point, yes, it remains silvery when it's melted. I forget the exact melting point. I think it's about 650 degrees centigrade or something, or 600 centigrade.
Right.
I forget the exact figure. And yes, if you just heat the aluminium up to 600 degrees centigrade, it will melt and it will still be silver in appearance. However, if you continue to heat it up, of course, it will still stay molten, but it will eventually start to glow red.
Right, okay.
And you can measure the temperature of something by the light that it gives off. It's called the black body radiation. And so this is something that Dr. Judy Wood was pointing out. But Jones, again, he tried to defend this and say it wasn't true. But again, you know, it's a simple experiment. You get some aluminium. You get, you know, Bunsen burner. To three Bunsen burners, four Bunsen burners, whatever it takes, and you heat it up and you'll see that what Jones said is untrue. So why was he lying about the behaviour of molten metal? Well, it must be to protect the knowledge that energy was important, a way of using energy, an unusual way of using energy was important in how the World Trade Center was destroyed. That's what the knowledge that he was protecting.
Absolutely, yeah.
And over time, that's simply become clearer and clearer. You know, and I've written, you know, you've referenced some of the things that we've talked about, and I've written about that, and you know, and all of that. That's all there. Anybody who wants any more specific information, please, you know, feel free to contact me through checktheevidence.com, and I'll try and explain anything they don't understand.
Great.
We'll get on to the John Hutchison thing.
Just
because,
before that, is it true to say, though, after these revelations that were brought forward by Dr. Judy Wood, there have in fact been, and a lot of people will be aware of this, there have actually been murders, threats, smear campaigns and all sorts of stuff going on?
Well, essentially, that's true, because going back to the experiment about the molten aluminium, it wasn't really actually an experiment, it was a demonstration.
Right.
Because Dr. Wood had done this in her laboratory, because she was working in materials engineering science, and she used to create her own diffraction gratings, which are used in optical experiments that she was doing.
Can I ask what they are? Sorry.
Well, the diffraction grating is like a little grid with microscopic little squares in it.
Okay.
Right, and they're very, very sort of small squares, which you wouldn't be able to see except with a high-powered microscope.
Okay.
And if you shine a laser light through a diffraction grating, you know where you get a laser and it's got like one spot?
Yeah.
Well, if you shine it through a diffraction grating, it'll break the spot into multiple spots.
Ah, right, okay.
And then you can use these diffracted beams for optical experiments on an optical bench, and that's what Dr. Wood was. That was, she'd been doing that for many years.
Okay.
She was an expert in that area, and so to make those gratings, my understanding is that one of the materials that you use is aluminium.
Okay.
And everyone, something that everyone can look at, you get a compact disc out from your collection if you've got one. You angle it towards the light and you see the rainbow effect.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That's because you've got these little tiny pits in the aluminium layer of the disc, because the CD has a very thin layer of aluminium in it, which is has little pits and lands in it which encode. They're the digital encoding of the music, or for your software, for your computer. Mm. And a diffraction grating, the way that it works, is related to this rainbow pattern that you see when you hold a CD up to reflect light off it.
Nice.
And so forth. Dr. Judy Wood familiar with all that, and Michael Zabur was her student. And he had sort of been in her lab and, helped set up this little experiment or this little demonstration.
Mm.
And then soon after that was posted, I think it was within a couple of weeks of that being posted, Michael Zabur was mysteriously shot in the head in a street mugging I think it was in Minnesota.
Right.
And another of Dr. Wood's students had their apartment set on fire.
Okay.
She had received, a threat by phone. She doesn't like to talk about this, by the way, because she just wants to talk about what happened.
Sure.
And why it's important to understand that.
Yeah.
But yes, that is true. She was threatened. A student was murdered. And the other peculiar thing was that her student's uncle, Michael Zabur's uncle, was a chap called William Zabur, and he worked with Dr. Eugene Malov on trying to raise awareness of alternative energy experiments and technologies, such as what became known as cold fusion.
Right.
So there was a definite demonstrable link there.
God.
Which, well, I would say that's probably significant.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I can't really say any more. So we've got this link to energy, 9/11, Steenly Jones, Dr. Eugene Malov, and so one of the effects that then is another energy effect is those effects created by John Hutchison, the Canadian researcher who has been working since the late 1970s. To reproduce the work of Nikola Tesla,
right.
Who, as most people will be aware, was doing all these experiments with high voltage electricity,
absolutely,
with large coils of copper wire, which again sort of follows on from the original work of people like Michael Faraday. And
just before you carry on, sorry to interrupt. Can I just? I had a quote I wanted to read out from Tesla. Sure. Actually, do you mind if I just read it now?
Mm.
One day, and I think it's one that you've used. At that presentation, one day man will connect his apparatus to the very wheelwork of the universe and the very forces that motivate the planets in their orbits and cause them to rotate, which will then rotate his own machinery.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Tesla was perfectly, I think through his own experiments, he'd become aware of this radiant energy field, I think it's he or radiant energy phenomenon.
Yeah.
And he felt that this could be exploited to power things without using, you know, hardly any fuel, if any fuel.
Sure.
And
is this why it's called sort of free energy?
Correct. Right. Correct.
Okay.
That's one of the, you know, interpretations of it. Yes.
Right. Sorry.
So no, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Please do that. So John Hutchinson was essentially, I suppose, investigating that very area, you know, being able to access energy fields to power things. And he'd looked at various Tesla experiments and tried to reproduce some of them using these high voltage Tesla coils.
Right.
And as you referenced earlier on, he found that over time, when he was trying to achieve various effects, you know, he was using high voltage electricity, he was using radar equipment, which emits certain frequencies of radio waves, and also he was using microwaves. And he was doing this, you know, I'm not sure of the exact configuration that he used, but he was doing this in various places. And if you go onto a website called thehutchinsoneffect.com and you read the about page on there, This is a website I set up for John a few years ago, you will be able to see a big long list of the kind of, you know, it's sort of like a mini biography of his life and how he started doing these experiments. By mixing together radio waves, microwaves, electrostatic fields, energy from a radioactive source, he was able to create these effects such as melting of metal, but the metal never became hot. In fact, it seemed to actually go cooler, jellification, he called it.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to create levitation. In other words, things would fly up into the air. And things next door, in the room next door to where he was, would break or fall off the shelf, you know, and this sort of thing. And I think he had a water main sort of blew up, a few times. Various, very strange things would happen. He would have a Geiger counter going next to his experiments. And what a Geiger counter can do is, it'll click off by itself because of the what's called background radiation. So there's always a level of background radiation coming from space, or so they tell us.
Right.
And you've got things like radon gas in certain areas, which is radioactive, and that occurs naturally.
Sure.
And a Geiger counter can detect that. And he noticed that when he ran his experiments, the Geiger counter would drop. You know, the readings on it would drop. Mm. So there was less apparent radiation when he was running his experiments. Less radiation detected, and then when he stopped, the Geiger counter would start counting more regularly again. So it had an effect on radioactive decay somehow. We didn't really know how.
Right.
And this was the other thing which came up in cold fusion experiments, which I didn't talk about earlier on, that they detected certain effects with both the emission of neutrons, which is a particle which is thought to be in the nucleus of the atom. It has no charge, that's why it's called a neutron.
Okay.
And there are certain effects on radioactivity. And so there appears to be some relationship between what John Hutchinson was doing and what happens in cold fusion experiments. You know, we don't know why, I still don't know why, but there's definitely a relationship there. And then what sort of came next was that Dr. Judy Wood, I was familiar with the Hutchinson effect. I'd become familiar with it in 1999, but I had no idea that it was related to what happened on 9/11.
Mm. You've actually interviewed John Hutchinson, haven't you?
I have, yes. You know, I've spoken to him a few times, and in fact, he ended up submitting an affidavit for Dr. Judy Wood's court case.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah, 30 years of research he submitted to the court. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was in 2007 or 2008, it might have been.
And what happened at that time then, when he did that?
Well, you know, that really, by then we'd established this energy connection. And so we felt it was important to point that out.
Sure.
In the court record, you know, in the public record, essentially.
Yeah.
And we knew that it was valid. Hmm. We knew there was enough data there to prove that there was some connection. You know, we weren't exactly sure what it was, but it was clear that there was this connection. And so while Jerry Leaphart was producing, or rather putting together, this court case for Dr. Judy Wood, which I can explain the background to very briefly.
Sure, yeah.
Because Dr. Wood had been doing this research essentially since day one, essentially since 2001, and she'd realised that something very unusual had happened, unlike everybody else who was sort of blind to it, actually, nearly everyone else, including me. She had been contacted by an attorney, and he pointed out that she could challenge the National Institute for Standards and Technology, who had produced these technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center, which were published in September 2005. So there was this government body, it had produced technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And the Jerry Leaphart said, look, Dr. Ward, if you want to challenge these reports, you can legally, you know, this is how you do it.
Wow.
And he set out how you would do that. So she basically said, look, Nest, you know, your report, this 10,000 page report is wrong. You have to correct it under the Data Quality Act, because there's a law in the US which says that if you're a government or a company, government department or a company, and you produce a report, you know, and it's wrong, and you get notified it's wrong, you have a legal obligation to correct that report, or you can be taken to court.
I like it.
So that's what, yeah, it was a good basis for a case. You know, I mean, a lot of people, just to pause on this a minute, a lot of people say, oh, Bush did 9/11, Israel did 9/11, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which those allegations may all well be true.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. But how do you prove it? How do you build that into a court case? How do you prosecute?
Yeah.
It would be very, very difficult, because a lot of it is, you know, sort of plausible deniability and all this sort of thing.
Indeed.
Jerry Leaphart knew that you could build a case on this. He knew that in a fair and open court, you know, where the evidence was properly heard and properly analysed, that Dr. Wood could win. He knew that.
Right.
And so she put this challenge in April 2007, which coincidentally was about a month before the founding of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, this group headed up by Richard Gage.
Okay.
That happened about a month after Dr. Wood's challenge to NIST went in.
Okay.
So she then put in this initial challenge, basically saying, look, here's the pictures, here's this picture, here's that picture, here's the seismic data, here's this chart. This proves that your report is wrong, because the towers did not collapse. They turned to dust before they hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So correct it now, or I'm going to sue your contractors for fraud, which is what they did.
Right.
And that went forward over the next year. The 9/11 Truth Movement would not even talk about this case. For example, I asked Annie Machon to talk about this case back in 2008, I think, when it was going through the courts. I asked her to talk about it in public because I had all the court documents. She refused to talk about it. She refused to discuss it in any of her presentations.
Mm.
So that was a cover-up of this court case by people who claim to be part of the 9/11 Truth Movement in the UK. And the same happened in the US.
Right.
You know, and I've written a lot about all of that. We then realised a bit after the initial court case had gone in that John Hutchison's research was related to what happened. You know, there were some effects that he'd seen because, for example, I usually tell the story of David Hansher, the photographer for the New York Daily News. And I may have even played this clip at the presentation you were at, where he says that he was levitated, or he was lifted, I think. I don't think he uses the word levitated. He was lifted and carried a block during the destruction of one of the towers. Other people report being picked up and thrown against the wall.
Wow.
We have Blaise Pasquale. He surfed down 20 floors and was unharmed and walked out unharmed. We have another guy, I forget his name, he dove under an ambulance as the tower was coming down, and then when he sort of, the tower had finished coming down, he looked up and the ambulance had gone from above him, but he was okay.
Nice. Wow.
So we have all this evidence that something very unusual happened.
Yeah.
9/11 Truth Movement doesn't want to talk about it. Jim Fetzer doesn't want to talk about it. Stephen Evan Jones claims it's thermite.
Yeah.
Richard Gage claims it was thermite and other explosives. So it's either nanothermite, superthermite, nukes, you know, anything but, basically.
Exactly. And the same old question with me. Why would, if you were an independent person interested in what actually happened, why would you not want to talk about it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, all that Dr. Wood has done is she's talked about the evidence, right?
Yeah.
I've talked about both the evidence and those, as I've just done right now, you know, those who are covering up this evidence.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so going back, just to finish off the sort of court case, as sure. much as we want to talk about now. So we approached John and said, look, would you be willing to submit an affidavit in relation to your experiments and how they relate to what Dr. Judy Wood has discovered in the evidence from the World Trade Center? Because that's essentially what we're talking about. She'd seen all these effects, levitation, you know, jellification of metal, ongoing effects, one possibly, you know, where this anomalous rusting, where steel was rusting very, very rapidly, that appears to be like this form of transmutation, you know, it's related to that, which is related to what happens in cold fusion experiments.
Right.
So he put all of that into an affidavit that was sent into the court of the Southern District of New York. The case was dismissed, I forget the exact date, by Judge George Daniels. And in his ruling, he mentioned the assassination of JFK and the moon landings, which had not been mentioned anywhere in any of the evidence that Dr. Wood had submitted.
Why did he mention that? Sorry.
Well, you have to write to him and ask him. But we have no clue.
Okay. Right.
It seemed, for instance, like he just copied some forum postings, you know, which would decry Dr. Wood and just pasted them into his courtroom. And that's what it looked like to me. But whether he did that or something else, you know, I don't know.
Hmm.
And then they made an appeal and the appeal was dismissed with the judges saying that they were going to ignore the law. The law had changed because there'd been a change in the Fraud Recovery Act. And they wrote in their ruling that they were going to ignore the change in the law about fraud recovery, which was what Dr. Wood's case was based on in law, and they were going to dismiss the case. And then it was sent to the Supreme Court, and they can just ignore it. You know, they don't have to hear any case, and they don't have to give a reason, even have to give a reason why they're not going to hear it, and they didn't. They just completely ignored it.
It's just unbelievable. And again, this is one of the biggest aspects, I think, isn't it, that happened post 9/11 again, that the massive amounts of government policies, both here and abroad, that actually changed.
Yes. Oh, yeah. 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 Very much so.
And that's what it all is based on to a large extent.
But you know, I suppose, you know, I was more expecting that the court system would ignore it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did what we could.
Yeah.
But what was more of a shock to me is that there was no support from within those groups that were meant to be looking at the truth of 9/11. In fact, it was the reverse, that there were people trying to cover it up, you know, and I've written about that. Which to me shows the importance of the energy issue and how it's connected into all of this.
Indeed.
You know.
Yeah.
And to me, there is no doubt at all that this energy question is central to what happened in the destruction of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
You know, I've been writing about this for the last 7 years, and I've got various articles on my website about aspects of this.
Mm.
And going back to the fireball that you mentioned, which we'll cover, that, you know, just to separate the two, because Dr. Wood mainly focuses on the destruction of the buildings, and if people wanted to get her book or watch her lectures online, of which there are quite a few, they will see that she doesn't talk much about the planes. And her reason is specific for doing that, in that, she, you know, she says whatever happened to the buildings wasn't, you know, if it was a real plane crash or a pod or no pod or a missile or not a missile or a holographic plane or not a holographic plane, whatever it was that was seen by people did not cause the buildings to turn to powder.
Right.
That there were two separate. The cause and effect of those was not really related.
Was something else that was said, that it was the very fact that both buildings actually collapsed in exactly the same way, exactly almost, that was slightly dubious.
Well, actually, that might seem to be the case, but that wasn't quite the case, because certainly one of them, the top of the building, turned to powder first, while the bottom remained intact.
Which one was that? One or two?
I think it was the second one.
Right.
And you can see the top kind of goes over at an angle, turns to powder, and this is a very interesting study in terms of the conservation of angular momentum from a physics perspective. Mm. And you can see just right there in this top section that it disobeyed the laws of physics. Mm. And the only way it can have disobeyed the laws of physics is that it turned to powder.
Right.
So there was no conservation of momentum in the normal sense, not in the sense of a solid object.
Okay.
So there were slight differences, and Dr. Wood's written about that in her book and on her website. So she separates the plane issue from the buildings issue so that you can focus on one at a time. I know that she's wanted to do a second book about, or at least covering, some of the aspects of the plane crashes.
Oh, right.
But she hasn't done that yet. I don't know whether she's going to do that. We've had a lot of problems because we've had to defend the attacks on the first book, which has used up an enormous amount of time over the last four or five years.
Sure.
But the fireball thing that I noticed that roundabout, you know, I thought real planes crashed probably until about 2005.
Right.
I then started to have questions raised in my mind when I noticed that if you watch the second plane crash, which was Flight 175, the Michael Herzakhani footage, if you watch that whole crash, you'll see, if you slow it down and do frame by frame, and you know, there's hundreds of YouTube videos of this now, you'll see that you can see this plane has gone right into the building, and there is no trace of any fireball, any flames, sparks, nothing. It's just a plane's gone into a building.
That's right, yeah.
And the next thing you essentially see is an explosion coming out of the side of the building, not the front.
Yeah.
So this, again, is an observation where we can see the laws of physics don't seem to be being followed. There is something else going on. And that observation was one I've kind of made for myself. Nobody seemed to have pointed that out before, so I kind of made a bit of a fuss about that. I think it was 2006 or 2007 when I first noticed that, and I posted a YouTube video of it, you know, slowing this down and putting in a freeze frame and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And that was my only video to get deleted.
Right, really?
Yeah, initially. It's back now because I re-uploaded it, but it had been there for about a year as well, and then it just randomly got deleted. As if it said it was, you know, in poor taste or something. I can't remember what it was. It was some strange message they put.
Right, okay.
So that was slightly odd. But there are all kinds of problems like that. When you start to study them, the speed of the crash was too high according to the official speed. There was no debris falling down. The plane wings didn't break off. The tail didn't break off. You know, there was all kinds of problems with that plane crash video. So I eventually came to conclude, following the work of Richard D. Hall, that what was witnessed by people was some type of image projection, because different people reported seeing different things from different vantage points.
Right.
Most people appeared to see what looked like a real plane. You know, the majority did, but I've certainly heard from a couple of people. That one person came up to me and told me that he was in direct line of sight of the second plane, never saw it.
Huh.
Never saw it. Some people didn't hear it. They were right under it, didn't hear it. You know, so. All kinds of anomalies with the witness accounts, and also the video record is if you study that in detail, it is also peculiar.
Right. Okay. All right then. I wanted to just move on to an article that was actually on your website that I mentioned to you earlier, and this is one that was called 9/11 and Human Consciousness, and it was written by a Swedish gentleman, and I'm going to let you say his name.
But yeah, Per G. Nordgren, I think is how you say it.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one. And I just wanted to read a quote from that, a short quote from that, which is as follows. The war on terror is in fact a war against human consciousness, a war against her spiritual ability to develop and retain a harmonious balance in the universe. The war on terror is a cover for reducing man to a battery, to a supply of energy to be used in a digital reality for those at the top of the food chain. Without this higher consciousness, man is reduced to a robot in a reality that can't be controlled by a computer-like creature. 9/11 was key to this process. And I just wanted to sort of touch on that slightly, because I think that's pretty key. And I was also reading something else that mentioned the, I don't know if it was in the same article now, about the occult ritualistic side of the whole thing, which I thought was quite intriguing too. And another bit I read which intrigued me was the fact it said that because flight, my mind's just gone blank on which flight it was that crashed, which was the one that crashed.
The 175 was the second crash.
No, which was the one that crashed into the field?
93, wasn't
it? 93, that was it. The fact that some people were saying that if it was done in a cult ritualistic way by whoever, then the original intention was for the three planes to hit, and that the reason that one building wasn't hit was because of the fact that this plane was sort of taken over by the passengers to some extent and crashed in a field. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I mean, the consciousness thing, I'd say definitely, you can look at the what's been happening, and it has. It was, in terms of consciousness manipulation, 9/11 was a global trauma-based mind control, initiation. Mm-hmm. That's what's happened. We were put into a state of trauma, which is essentially a change in consciousness or an attack on consciousness. And so they knew the way that it was done, the timing, like, for example, as I've been before, the timing, the time of day that it was set to happen was also deliberate, in that it happened at about 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
So that meant that one side of the US coast would get the story straight away in the morning. And then it ran for the whole day, which was by the time the other side of the coast of America, they would pick up the story at the end of the day.
In regards to the UK, it was just after lunchtime as well, so everybody had come back for lunch and was able to watch it.
Yeah, and that kind of thing. So you can see that it was time for maximum impact on our consciousness, our awareness, and seeing it and being in a state of trauma. And I personally remember how I felt. I was literally... I remember walking, up to the post office, I think the same day or the next day, and I was shivering. Mm. I was actually shivering, even though it wasn't a winter's day or anything like that. Obviously, it was September. It had a physical effect on me, even though I was completely remote from the events.
Sure.
And I'm sure there are other people that experience more extreme things. So definitely attack on human consciousness. Mm. I'm not sure about this, The way that the occult angle with the number of planes crashing or intended to crash, that's a bit more speculative. I take the conclusion really that there weren't any real planes that actually crashed. So any stories of them being, taken over by passengers, that's all just a fairy story, really. And in essence, a bit like the stories of bombs in the building, it doesn't matter in terms of the actual physical reality of those stories, because the stories themselves have had the effect. In other words, people say, did they plant bombs in the building to confuse people away from thinking about directed energy weapons, and all the stuff I've just talked about in the last half an hour or so. And I'm saying, well, there was no need for them to do that, because they've put out all these stories since at least 2006, probably before, and that's convinced many people there were bombs in the building. So the stories have worked just as well. So why did they actually need to do it? I think the same can be said of the plane crash stories about them intending to have aimed for building number 7, or instead of the crashing in the field and da-di-da.
That begs the question, why did building seven collapse when nothing hit it?
Indeed. Well, that remains a leading question. But in fact, building 7 did not collapse. It turned to powder a period of time.
Right.
Before it hit the ground. And I used to say collapse all the time. I'm much more careful about that now.
Sure.
Because this is part of the psychological operation and the attack on consciousness, that it stops you from being aware of what actually happened.
Andrew, has there been an official sort of justification of why building 7 did collapse?
Yes, there has. NIST did another report. I think it was published in, forget the exact date, I should know. But Dr. Wood also submitted comments to that. That's all on her website, because they invited public comments about the World Trade Center number 7 report. They did a separate report, in other words.
Right.
The initial ones came out in 2005. And then the World Trade Center 7 one came out either in 2007 or, no, it would have been after then, wouldn't it? Might have even been 2009, you know, it's a long time afterwards. I'd have to go and check. But yes, so they did, they said it was central, one of the, a couple of the central columns had become heated, too heated, and they buckled and the building collapsed in on itself. So it was failure due to, you know, certain girders failing, failing. And they did give, you know, they produced a computer model and they listed which particular girders had failed. And it was all just, you know, ridiculous because if the building had fallen, it would have created a seismic signature, but it didn't. It created a seismic signature barely above background noise. So it was very quiet. There was, you know, you can even watch an interview with somebody. There's an interview with somebody about four or five blocks from building number seven. They're talking to them and they're in the middle of the interview. They're going, whoa, look, look, look. And building number seven is going down. In other words, and there's no sound. You could still hear the conversations going on. You know,
isn't there an actual interview as well that is someone saying that it's gone down and before it's gone down, because it's in the background?
The Jane Stanley thing, that also is.
Does this beg the question that this was almost the whoever powers that be sort of taking the piss to an extent that they think, well, if people don't get and see this, then they deserve everything they're going to get?
Well, this is part of the fact, you know, this going back to the occult thing, that my understanding of the way that works is the occult symbology and symbolism works that if you don't notice it, but it's there, you know, and it's going into your subconscious, but you're not smart enough or your brain is not, you know, working in the right way. They are having power over you because you've essentially consented to that, whatever it is, you know, 9/11, all these other horrible things. They've told you what they're going to do. You know, but you haven't been smart enough to figure it out. So that's the way that occult rituals often work. And yes, so that's the sort of taking the piss element, if you want to call it that. Yeah, I think it is. There is like that. And what I've pointed out with 9/11, or not, you know, what I've agreed with on 9/11, other people have pointed it out. I'm not claiming any credit. Is, you know, the occult symbolism in terms of the number 11, you know, 9/11. The towers looked like a number 11 on the horizon. Each of the towers had 110 stories, you know, that's an 11 with a zero on the end. You know, they apparently started building them in 1966.
That's the year I was born.
And then there's also the Millennium Hotel, which was just across the road, and 9/11 happened in the first year of the new millennium. So you're not supposed to count from zero. So 2001 was actually the new millennium, not 2000, if you see what I mean. So you've got those sorts of things built into the you know.
And of course, there's a lot of people that believe that this event was foretold for centuries before anywhere. I don't know if it was Nostradamus, but there's been various people that have depicted almost the scenario of two towers going down.
Absolutely, yes. As you know, the tarot cards and this sort of thing, you know, so I don't know how far that goes. Some of it may be relevant and correct, and some maybe not quite as relevant and correct, but I have no problem in sort of point, you know, agreeing with those that say this was part of an occult ritual. It was, and that ties into the effects on human consciousness as well. It's a form of black magic. You know, and they're casting a spell on you every day when 9/11 gets mentioned. That's and right. Terrorism, et cetera, et cetera.
And essentially, as you even said yourself, the way you felt the next day, it's reducing us to a constant state of fear and intrepidation, which takes...
Trepidation.
Which takes away our ability to kind of properly connect with our spiritual selves, I think. And then we give the power away to those who shout out terrorism and pretend to protect us against war and destruction.
That's all part of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And it's essentially again, Dr. Judy Wood's book gave us the evidence that the whole scenario could well have been orchestrated like a well-directed sort of piece of theatre using a technology that we're not supposed to be aware of, and this kind of led a lot of people again getting up, touching on the occult thing again. It was people do say that this whole thing was done to mark the so-called beginning of the end times.
Yes. And I was just sent some interesting information in relation to that. I don't really believe in these end times predictions myself, because so many of them have become out to be false.
That's,
you know,
right.
I've done a presentation about that, actually, or not just about that specifically, but it includes that information.
Yeah.
But you know, people want to fit it into that scenario, and I think it kind of has a relevance, but maybe not quite as some people would claim.
Sure.
One thing that's interested me recently that I was sent is this idea of the astrological ages, in that, you know, we're leaving the age of Pisces and now entering the age of Aquarius.
Yeah.
And from what I've just been sent recently, I haven't studied this properly. This person has claimed that the timing of the event of 9/11 might be to do with the entry into the age of Aquarius.
Right.
Which is very interesting to me.
There's a lot of very, very interesting stuff out there, I think, isn't there? It's going to be very interesting times ahead. Okay, I just want to move on then briefly to two. I want to discuss the Keshe Foundation shortly, but before that, I just wanted to briefly touch on a few people that have been working in the free energy field, and we have obviously already talked about that. But I did want to just run a couple of people by you. Wilbert Smith was one of them. And this was the magnetic sink circuit, which I'll get you to explain exactly what that is. But the bit I found very interesting about the whole of that was that he says that a lot of the information that he was privy to was given to him by, people not on this planet.
Yes, I mean, again, I'd urge anyone who's not familiar with Wilbert Smith's case to look at Grant Cameron's website or the presentation that I put together based on Grant Cameron's research, which he put together over a period of 25 years. Mm. And Smith, a little thumbnail sketch of him, he became superintendent of radio regulations in Canada in the 1940s, late 40s. And he was an expert in geomagnetics, looking at how the Earth's magnetic field affects things like radio wave propagation, in other words, how radio waves propagate through the atmosphere. And that sort of thing. And he got interested in the subject of flying saucers, UFOs, and he eventually said that he came into contact with these people, as you sort of alluded to there, he called them the boys' top side, these beings that were coming here, and they're in contact with somebody called Francis Swan, who he knew.
Yeah.
And then it seemed like he was given information directly later on. And then he came up with this idea of doing an experiment related to gravity, where he would rotate a disc at about 16,000 revolutions per minute. Mm. And he had some way of measuring the weight of an object, which was just above this disc or placed in the central section. And he would then... just hang on one second.
Yeah, no problem, yeah.
So he had this rotating disc, and then the weight would be reduced by about 1%. So you know, you perfectly acknowledge that this was a very small amount, but then he said, you know, if he could work on this experiment more, they could, you know, could improve the effect of it. Mm. And as you mentioned, he created this. So that was basically an a gravity reduction experiment. He started doing research into it. And he worked on that for a number of years, apparently, according to what Grant had found out.
Right. Okay.
And he presented this at a science fair, or he was going to present it at a science fair. And then they started imposing various terms and conditions on his presentation. And he backed out. He said, look, you know, the world's not ready for my gravity experiment, so okay. I'm sorry, I'm not going to show it.
That leads on to, I wanted to just briefly mention, is it Schauberger? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Victor Schauberger, yeah.
I don't know if he was before or after. Was he before or after?
He was before, yeah. He was doing stuff in the 30s and 40s in Germany.
Right, and he was creating vortexes in water and working on anti-gravity effects, and he also had the Nazis approached him because they wanted to take up some of the work, is that right?
That's correct, isn't it? That's my understanding, yeah. And I think Gene Manning has written a bit about that, if my memory serves me correctly. So, yeah, he had this thing where he'd suck water into this kind of spinning, like a spinning top almost, you know, it looked like one of these spinning tops. Mm. And as this accelerated to a certain velocity, he said that it would actually, you know, take off, it would lift off the ground. And I was speaking to somebody very recently in the last couple of months who's been to the Schauberger Museum, which I think is in Austria. I might have got that. I think it was in Austria.
Sounds right, yeah.
But there was, he reckoned that stuff had been, the good stuff had kind of been taken away, you know, and there was just kind of a sort of remnants that were, you know, quite interesting, but didn't go, get into the hardcore stuff of the exotic sort of effects, you know.
Okay.
But yeah, so the Schauberger, Smith developed this magnetic sink circuit, which was basically a small circuit where you could extract energy from the Earth's magnetic field.
Right.
It's not a circuit I've attempted to build, but the circuit diagram is online. I don't think it's that sophisticated of a circuit. I don't know how efficient it is. But
when you say sink, what do you mean by sink? You mean?
Well, a sink means where you know. You have in science, you can have a source or a sink. In other words, a source is where something comes out of,
yeah,
and a sink is where something collects.
Oh, okay.
So a magnetic sink is where you collect the, you know, you have a collection of magnetic energy or, you know, magnetic flux
with you,
and from that sort of sink you can extract or gather or collect some type of energy.
I was visualising a kitchen sink, but I get
you
now.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, it's sort of like that. I can't remember if it's the same spelling, but sink, you know, you put the plug in the sink and that's where you collect
the
water.
Yeah,
so there is an analogy there.
See the tie there. Okay, yeah. And Wilhelm Reich, who was the orgone man, yeah? And
yes,
he said
yeah.
that energy is, orgone is the energy from which everything else is made, which I thought was quite an interesting statement.
Yeah, well, I think that might be my sort of paraphrasing of what he actually said. Whether he used those words,
sure.
I'd have to go and check. But so that might be me paraphrasing him. But he felt that there was this kind of energy all around us, and he called it orgone. And he used his experiments. You know, he'd done experiments with orgone energy in the 1930s and 40s, and he used these to develop a therapy. And he used built these orgone accumulators, which were basically these wooden, like a wooden crate almost, that you'd sit in, and you could get certain therapeutic effects.
Right.
You know, on these, you know, by sitting in these for periods of time. But he was mainly doing it for, you know, essentially medicinal or therapeutic reasons. He also found that he could direct this orgone energy using these cloud busters.
Right, that's when I mentioned that with the chemtrails thing,
And other people seem to have reproduced these experiments over the years, and as you mentioned, the cloud busters have now been made with, and I was speaking to somebody over the weekend actually at the Exopolitics conference, and she'd done quite a lot of investigation, I think more than I had, into Reich's research, and she was saying if you do build a cloud buster, you've got to be very careful with it because it can actually be quite dangerous.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way dangerous?
Well, I think in the way that you direct the energy, it can have sort of slightly harmful effects over a period of
right.
time, you know.
Okay.
So, and she's not the first person to say this. I've heard this before. And there's a book called The Orgone Accumulator Handbook, which you can download by Joseph DeMeo. So if anybody's thinking of having a play around, you know, try and find that and download it and have a read of it.
Nice, right.
Before you go too far.
And I have heard a few. Sorry, go on. Sorry.
Yes, because like the little orgone pieces, I think they are, you know, I don't think there's any problem with those. The little ones that you can get, you know, pendants and
sure.
these little, I think not too many issues with those. But when you build something big with these crystals,
indeed.
Copper pipes
yeah.
and this sort of thing, I think there's a bit more you've got to be careful of there, you know.
Okay, and I have heard stories from certain people apparently that have built these things that as soon as they do it and sort of put it into operation, they suddenly get the black helicopters coming over.
I've heard this too. I've not seen it with my own eyes, but yeah, I've heard the same stories. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was slightly interested in keeping on Reich for a moment. The fact that you said that he was actually an assistant to Sigmund Freud, and how did that fit in with what he did exactly?
Well, he came into this. Or he was studying human sexuality,
right,
you know, and the
okay.
way that people interact in relationships, and he had this very strong. Sort of feeling that there was this type of energy which people exchanged in their relationships, and it was that an imbalance in that sort of energy exchange which created psychological problems.
Okay.
Which was kind of different to what Freud eventually was saying, because he said it was all to do with sexual repression and stuff like that, and repressed sexual feelings. And Reich, although not totally removed from that idea, he had a considerably different take on what Freud eventually came up with. And And so he went down a related, but I think substantially different field of research. And that was my understanding of you know what how that all panned out. Now there is apparently a new documentary coming out about Wilhelm Reich, which was crowdfunded. I contributed to that.
Last year.
I'd have to go and check when it's coming out, but I think it should be out within the next 12 months.
Right, fantastic. Was he essentially saying then, was he going down the line that how our energies can affect others?
I think it was that type of approach, but he went kind of further and said that although, you know, we can exchange this energy between people, other people have then looked at the more physical aspects and manifestation of that energy. And they built, for example, motors. Dr. Eugene Mallow talked about these. They built motors which run off orgone energy. You know, they're only like little tabletop motors which spin little discs or something like that, or little spindles. They're not great big things that you put in a car or anything like that. So apparently this orgone energy can be, manipulated.
Right.
A physical level, as well as within, you know, sort of personal relationships, and it can be used for health treatments, and so forth.
Right. And of course, we've seen, this is just flit through my head then, we see so many sci-fi sort of films or whatever, which is based on the so-called aliens, I hate the word alien, but that are driving these vehicles. It's all done by them touching, it's sensory, it's done with power from energy coming from them.
Well, exactly. And I mean, going back to Wilbert Smith, you know, that he became sort of famous in the UFO community because of this memo that he wrote in 1950, you know, all the way back in 1950, saying that he'd been told that secret teams in the USA were investigating the crashed discs and the flying saucer phenomenon. Mm. He actually used this phrase that he thought the operation of the craft, I could get the exact phrase, but it'll just take me a minute to pull up. But he thought the operation of the craft, the Americans were doing research into mental phenomena which were related to the operation of the craft.
Right.
So that memo was dated 1950.
Right.
So it would appear that they knew that then. You know, they knew that psychic or mental phenomena were related to how the craft were either propelled or how they were now, you know, how they were steered, how they were made to go in a certain direction.
Sure. And there is a line of thought that people believe that this kind of information goes back far, far, far further than the 1950s, and people have known about it. Certain people have known about it for a very long time. I want to just touch on the Keshe Foundation now. And just before that, I just want to read out something else about Tesla, in that basically his experiments proved that there is a radiant energy field present everywhere, but it just needs the right equipment to attract it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that again is my understanding. I think those are my words.
And probably is. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's fine though, because that's correct. That's my understanding of what Tesla was saying. And you can demonstrate this using things like the hairpin circuit experiment, which, you know, if you just put into YouTube hairpin circuit experiment, Tesla or something, you'll find some people have reproduced this. And I think I showed in that presentation this chap called Carl Paulsness, and he actually has a bulb, an electric bulb, you know, that you normally put in a light socket, and he puts it in a bowl of water, and he runs the hairpin circuit, and this thing lights up when it's underwater. You know, and he doesn't get he puts his hand in the bowl and he flicks his fingers about, and he doesn't get electrocuted.
Okay.
So what you can see is that whatever electrical energy is making that bulb come alight, it is not the same type of electrical energy that's coming out of the socket on your wall or comes out of a battery, because as soon as you put that form of electrical energy into water, it shorts out and you can get an electric shock, or the bulb just won't light. May not give you a shock, but it just won't work. It'll just short out.
Okay.
So this is clearly a different type of energy that Tesla was able to demonstrate. So people can do some research into that.
Sure. Okay. All right then. Well, that does take me on to a gentleman called Miran Kesh, who some people have actually equated as being the modern day Tesla. And I did just want to touch on this because there's been a lot happening recently around this Kesh Foundation, which could have major impact on the world and the way that we live. And just to give people a little bit of background on this, the Kesh Foundation gave a presentation last Friday evening in Rome, where it was presented to third world ambassadors, the ones who had turned up, they'd all been invited, and to the ones who turned up, he presented, Miran Kesh presented his free energy devices, and these are devices that he claims could change the world in terms of power, energy, health, and so much more. And when I say power as well, I mean that in two ways, by way of energy and power by way of people who control the planet. And he gave each of these ambassadors that turned up one of his plasma energy boxes free, with a memory stick containing all the information apparently needed about the device. And he asked each ambassador to take it back to the leaders of their country with a view to giving this to the people. And he told them he was going to give them 10 days to actually take this process forward. And after that time, he's going to present more information to the world that will apparently allow us all to make these devices ourselves and free ourselves from those who seem to have control over us. And it's a very bold promise, obviously, and statement. Just to give a little bit more background, Kesh was born in Iran in 1958, and he was the son of an X-ray engineer. And he was introduced to the world of radiation and nuclear science at a very young age. And he travelled around the world with his father, speaking to many, many scientists. And he did, in fact, study in England at Queen Mary College, graduated in 1981 as a nuclear engineer. And he spent years since then completing a system, we are told, for the production of gravity and energy using a radioactive hydrogen-fueled reactor that is claimed is clean and safe. So that was all that what happened last Friday. I did watch this. It was like nearly 3 hours long on Friday. And I've got to say, I haven't been aware of Kesh before this. And I know many of you have. And things like this have happened before. But I found that the whole thing was actually very moving, the way it was done. And that the energy that came off that was very moving and very inspiring. And I just thought maybe you could give me a little bit of your opinion on what you've sort of seen and heard about the Kesh Foundation.
Certainly, and I think there's a couple of things. You know, I've seen a number of similar presentations over the last 10 years, basically.
Yeah.
And we've had various figures, you know, trying to do this sort of thing, something similar. And you know, like Keshe, they appear on the surface to have good amount of knowledge. And you mentioned his background as a nuclear engineer. You know, that would seem to be ideal. Mm. For, you know, looking into these energy effects. You know, I mean, I'm not a nuclear engineer. Part of my degree was in physics, and I did chemistry A level, which is how I can sort of talk with a little bit of confidence about some of the things I have today.
Nice.
And it does give me a little bit of an edge over some people on, you know, whether these people are talking complete nonsense, you know, which some of them are. But certainly in Mr. Keshe's case, I first heard of him in 2011, and he said he'd produced this generator in 2011,
right,
which he was offering for sale at, I think, a price of either $5,000 or £5,000.
Okay.
I think, you know, my understanding, I don't know anyone who stumped up the $5,000 or pounds. But my understanding is that people really did stump up the money and send it to him because they had confidence that he was, you know, he was the real deal. He was going to produce the goods,
yeah,
and they were going to have these 2 kilowatt or 5 kilowatt generators to put in their house. You know, goodbye Scottish Power, you know, goodbye, you know, Aon or whoever you might talk about, you know, and away you go. And if that had been the case, then truly wonderful. You know, that would be one of the key strings of control broken.
Of course.
You know, perhaps the other two being, or two of the other ones being money and health. You know, if we can break the energy string,
yeah,
then that's going to, you know, the Cry Freedom title of your show, that's going to be one of the big cries to go out.
Indeed,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but, you know, in my experience, I mean, again, I experienced this with the BCG group. Just dive onto that for a minute because it's kind of similar.
Sure.
Dr. Michael Clark said in front of an assembled audience in 2012 that his group was working on a free energy device to give to BCG members.
Right.
Based on, what was it, based on a fuel cell, a water fuel cell, and he said it was looking promising. Mm. Now, six months later, when I had a meeting with him and other people, it was revealed that he had no such device at all. And I asked, I sort of probed him on this a bit, and he said, oh, yeah, well, the thing that we were working on a few years back, you know, it worked, but, you know, we can't actually use that to go forward with anything. Okay. It's just not going to be a viable thing. So he'd actually contradicted himself.
I suppose there could be a number of reasons for that, which we'll probably never know. And I suppose it could be anything from, yeah, maybe it wasn't out and out live from the beginning, or maybe he's been worked on from certain areas to make him withdraw that claim.
Well, possibly. I tend to think it was that the thing never existed in the first place.
Why do that then? Why?
Well, I think, you know, in my way of looking at it, it's to manipulate people, to string them along, you know, and give them false hopes. Okay. So that they won't look elsewhere.
Okay.
Certainly with Mr. Keshe, you know, he comes across very well, and as you say, he's made these moving speeches.
Yeah.
But I don't think he does himself any favours when he posts on his Facebook page, you know, and I sent you the link earlier, that he thinks he's the Messiah and he's come to help us all out, you know, and... You know, it's just not a good way of doing it, because people in the scientific community are going to laugh at that.
Yeah.
So even if his claims are real,
yeah,
you know, he should keep them to himself.
Yeah.
Because you know, he should keep the claims about being the Messiah to himself.
You think, why would you do that? Because you're just adding, you know, skepticism.
Yeah, you're just putting more barriers in front of yourself, you know, to get your device accepted. But the other problem that always comes up, and I think, you know, we know from what happened at the World Trade Center that this energy technology has already been turned into a weapon system, right? Mm. And that's the realization that I came to in 2008, maybe 2009, right? Yeah. And that is never talked about in the free energy community. As I was saying earlier on, right, nobody in the 9/11 truth movement, or, you know, hardly anybody, next to nobody, perhaps I would be more accurate in saying, would talk about Dr. Wood's research.
Okay.
It's been changed a bit now because partly because people like Richard D. Hall and myself, we've continued to apply pressure to people to get this accepted for what it is, as in the truth. And the same in the free energy community. In other words, whoever destroyed the World Trade Center clearly had a motive to destroy the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
It didn't happen by accident. It was clearly intended for all the reasons that we've already discussed tonight. So they also have a reason for keeping this energy technology under wraps, for keeping it tightly compressed.
Yeah.
And for example, whether this is true or not, I don't know, but somebody said to me, right, when I did a presentation similar to that one you saw, the one that I did at one at Leeds I did, that I did that in Holland, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, I've heard that the NSA or the government or this controlling group, whoever it is, they've got a system whereby if anybody switches on a device, a free energy device, which is, you know, really is a free energy device, it's pulling energy out of the vacuum, or it's, you know, regenerating orgone energy or gathering it, or whatever it is, whatever form of energy it actually is, as soon as that is switched on, if it's generating more than 3 kilowatts of power, which is about what you need to boil a kettle, that there's a field or a system which detects that, and they can pinpoint it, and then that person will get a visit.
Right, okay. Right?
So the laboratory will be burned down, or the person will be persuaded not to continue, or they'll serve them with a tax court summons or something.
Yeah.
You know, they'll put the clamps on it, and judging by what I've seen with the Lutec device, with, you know, Tesla's work, with Pons and Fleischmann's work, you know, probably if I went back to my list, I could probably give you 4 or 5 other examples fairly quickly. Stan Meyer's another one. That has been the pattern, right? So if Keshe was genuinely telling the truth, I think the pattern you're going to see in the next year is that device, whatever it is, it will not come into general use.
Yeah.
The point being that until there is a wider realization that they've weaponized this technology, they used it to destroy the World Trade Center, we're not really going to see any change from the pattern which has been going on for probably the last 100 years. You know, T. Henry Moore is another one. He'd produced a free energy device in the 40s or 50s, and he was running banks of light bulbs and stuff using this special type of capacitor, I think it was. Nice. And then that all disappeared, yeah. You know.
Is it right that a lot of this is based on plasma as well?
Well, that's what Keshe claims. Yeah. I did have a quick look at a while ago at his reactor technology, and I must say I didn't really understand it. And what other postings I read, which were, you know, weren't just kind of debunking, they were trying to actually, you know, properly understand what he was saying. They didn't seem to understand what he was saying either. Not it didn't seem to make a lot of sense to them.
Okay.
And as I said to you, you know, when we were discussing this earlier, he posted on his forum, he designed this reactor with no physical structure, you know, and I'll maybe try and find that link and send it to you. To me, that I don't understand that. I don't know where he's coming from, because all reactors that we would use have to have a physical structure so that you can plug wires into them, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, again, we talked about these other kind of more way out things, for want of a better phrase, of being able to actually, you know, fire out energy from your hands. You know, and some people appear to be able to do that. I mean, these people who can heal. There's a good video with oh, crikey, The Power of Chi. It's called The Power of Chi. If you put that into YouTube, you'll see that there's an interview with this guy. I think he's based in Java, in the Far East somewhere. And he set some newspaper on fire with his hand, you know,
okay.
In the street.
Right.
It's incredible.
Right.
So yes, I Keshe's sort of idea of, you know, being able to manifest energy, I think certain people can do that. These Chi masters, for example,
yes.
They appear to be able to, you know, manifest energy in a physical reality that does things. You know, and that's incredible. It's totally incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But whether that can be made into a physical device that we can, you know, have in our homes and use it to cook food and power laptops and so on, you know, that people seem to have made these devices. Whether Keshe has got one, well, I, for one, am not yet convinced that's the case.
Sure, okay, I appreciate all that. I think time's going to tell, and I think in some ways it will tell quite quickly on this one, only because I actually do know, and I do have friends in various parts of the country, world, in fact, that have ordered his device, which he is now selling on his website, apparently, for €500. And as well, obviously, he's supposed to have given these all out to various ambassadors too, but I do actually know independent people that have ordered this device and are expecting delivery of it, and they are going to, if they ever get it, they are going to keep me posted on whether it actually works or not, which will be very interesting.
It will. I mean, I'm pleased that they've been able to sort of stump up that sort of money with that level of confidence. And
sure.
Yes, of course, I definitely, please keep me posted.
Absolutely.
Too, because I don't know anyone who's ordered one, so that'd be very, I'd be very interested to hear,
okay,
about
sure.
It. Of course,
as well, anyway. Sure, and I guess that will be the telling of it all. I mean, we'd all love to believe all of this, of course, because it would be immense and it would be amazing and it would be completely and utterly planet and world changing. So.
Absolutely. Well, don't get me wrong. I know that these devices are real. I've seen enough of them and heard enough stories about them that I know that it is possible to produce these effects. It is possible that we could have such a generator in our own houses.
Yeah.
You know, I'm convinced of all of that. It's just that I think the hurdles are getting that into a large-scale production and getting past these global cartels which work in horrible and devious and evil and greedy ways,
yeah,
to keep these things out of our use.
Of course, yeah, completely agree. Okay, well, we've been going for sort of 1 hour 45 now, so I did want to, I think I'll have to sort of wrap it up shortly, but I did want to touch, Andrew, on the whole chemtrails issue, because I know that's something that's you've worked on quite a lot. I know that you've done a lot of research into it, and as I told you, I did listen to a recent radio show that you hosted, and you were actually talking to Dr. Judy Wood again on this subject, and you said essentially that geoengineering is the modifying of the Earth's atmosphere, which is being instigated by an overall control group with an agenda, and this control group has, as it does with everything else, created attacking factions to cover up what in fact is going on. And you did say, of course, human activity is damaging the environment. That has got to be undeniable. But this has been used in a way to manipulate people with the same old thing, the old fear thing. And I think you mentioned that you'd written an article recently reinvestigating climate change. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Yeah, I mean, I'm really pleased that you've actually read what I've written and are able to sort of write, you know, noted that down and quote that back. I mean, I may say that that's quite unusual that I get that with a
review. Right. So, okay.
You know, you've really done your homework. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
I suppose, you know, my thinking has been shaped by what happened with the 9/11 research, as I sort of outlined earlier on, in that there's the official story, then you set up a truth movement of one kind or another, but then you find that parts, or often large parts of that truth movement, are themselves putting out a second cover story.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that, in the case of 9/11, it was the bombs in the building or nukes or those sorts of things. They are also untrue. When you study the evidence, they're also untrue. Mm. And then you get people fighting, the bombs in the building people fight the official story people, you know, on internet forums, and, you know, and they confront people in public, you know, they confront politicians and stuff like that. And they say, oh, we know it was bombs in the building, you know, and the politician goes, no, it wasn't, you know, and yes, it was, you know, and that sort of thing goes on. But what I've found is that there is this, that's the second tier of the cover-up. So they should be going at politicians and saying the building's turned to dust, which is what actually happened. Mm. But that's too big of an issue. So we then come to the climate issue. And then, of course, we have the, we're undergoing global warming. And, you know, you'll see in the papers, these climate change deniers, you know, and they're all evil. And they're like Holocaust deniers, which is what, of course, Paul McCartney said.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Sir Paul McCartney
said.
Yeah,
get it right, yeah.
he said, you know, climate change deniers are as bad as Holocaust deniers. He said that. That was published, I think, in The Sun, 3 or 4 years ago. Mm. And so you get this confrontation, people fighting each other, but, you know, you get the Hadley climate change, climate research unit. Their emails get leaked, that they falsified data and they admit this in email and da da da. And then you get all these people saying, oh, you know, we're being sprayed with toxic chemicals. Look up at the skies, everyone. We're all going to be poisoned with nanochips or aluminium, barium, strontium. We're all going to die. You know, our kids are going to die, and your kids are being poisoned. And I read all of this stuff, you know, starting from, again, the same time frame, 2003, 2004, that sort of thing. And latterly, I decided that I would try and actually try and do some scientific study, you know, and I think it is scientific, of the chemtrail issue. Mm. And I wanted to determine, for example, if there was any provable link between the amount of air traffic and the number of chemtrails or trails that you see. I have no, you know, I can see, just as everyone else can see, that we get these trails, you know, grids, lines, strange circles. Mm. And, you know, people have sent me pictures. I've taken pictures myself. I've got hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. I've got videos.
And not always, all and kinds it's not of always every day, of course. It's correct. Not...
Exactly, and that's part of the mystery. It's not every day, and it's not on days that you would necessarily expect. And that was part of my problem with this issue. If they're trying to poison us with stuff from the sky, it seems to be like a very inefficient way of doing it. You know, if they wanted to poison us, why not make it invisible? They would have a way of doing it invisibly and silently.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing that people can think about. So I began to think, well, what's actually going on? And when I did this study, which lasted over 9 months, I wasn't really able to prove, for example, because I developed this little, without going into all the details, I developed this little sort of setup from various bits and pieces that I'd found out about and looked at on forums and da-di-da, where I could count the number of aircraft that came over my house, you know, in a given period, an hour or a day, and I could photograph the sky and count the number of trails that occurred on that same day. So I could count the number of aircraft and count the number of trails, essentially, and see if there was a correlation between those two things. And I came up, after 9 months of research, that there was no particular correlation between these two things.
Okay.
In other words, when I saw a lot more trails in the sky, there was no detectable increase in the amount of detected air traffic. In fact, it came out slightly the reverse. In other words, the more trails we saw, the slightly less aircraft were detected.
Really?
And you know, this was a lot of work, don't get me wrong. I spent a few hundred pounds on this, probably about £400 or £500 on getting all this equipment, actually more if I was to add it all up. So it wasn't something I did lightly. And I had to use some of my software knowledge, you know, which I've developed over the last 30 odd years to make all this work and solve a few technical problems, which I did. But you know, all these people that write about chemtrails and have made postings, they seem to have very little interest in this. This was an objective study. I tried to use, you know, a particular sort of method which I wrote about, and I've written it all up into a report. I encouraged people to get hold of this tracking equipment, which costs about £100, probably less. And, you know, I offered to send this to them and da-de-da. Very little interest in this.
Nice.
And eventually I came to the conclusion that what I think we're seeing is a lot of the, and I'm not saying this is all the trails, but a lot of them appear to be the side effect of some ongoing geoengineering activity, which is causing the trails to appear at certain times.
Okay.
In other words, if I can phrase it, that it appears that the atmosphere has been affected by energy. And then that energy field, or the energy impinging on the atmosphere from somewhere else, I know not where, is causing effects, which one of which is the appearance of more aircraft trails.
Okay,
right. So not in every case, but in many cases, what we're seeing is an effect of geoengineering, not you know, a deposit of toxic chemicals.
Okay, and geoengineering to what effect?
Geoengineering to control the weather,
okay.
In other words,
okay.
to give us particular sets of weather conditions. And I think if you look at the number of cloud anomalies and try and observe cloud anomalies,
yes,
as well as the trails that you see, and I made a few of these time-lapse videos, because one of the things that came out of this, which I found extremely interesting, was the number of cloud anomalies, which I was able to pick up on time-lapse videos.
Okay.
Because I had these things running 24/7,
right.
You know, and I had like weeks and weeks of time-lapse videos of the sky from four or five trackers around the country.
Right.
You know, I was able to, and I've written all this up, you know, if people want to read about it. You can see in a couple of these videos, four or five of these videos, these strange cloud anomalies, which I don't think should be there.
Yeah.
You know,
and people have certainly posted a lot of pictures of clouds, which they think look extremely unusual.
Yeah. You know, and so I think what we're seeing is essentially to cut to the sort of quick, as it were, the chemtrail stuff that's put on the internet that we're all being poisoned. That's kind of a cover for this ongoing geoengineering program,
right.
And the other aspect that I relate to that is what happened with Hurricane Erin.
Just going to mention that. Please do.
Which, if you look at the data from Hurricane Erin, which was found by Dr. Judy Ward in 2008, you can see that this hurricane, you know, hit Bermuda on the 7th of September, and then it travelled in a straight line for 4 days towards New York City, and the storm system moved at its slowest speed across the surface of the ocean. During the events of 9/11, it reached its widest expanse during the 9/11. The barometric pressure I don't think changed in 16 hours, neither did the temperature nor the humidity while those events were going on over New York City. And then on the 12th of September, it made a right-hand turn and headed off out towards Newfoundland. Now, to me, you know, I could be wrong, and I don't think Dr. Woodick says this like I do. She would just tell you what I just told you.
Yeah.
But I would say what you're looking at is a piece of geoengineering, very finely tuned geoengineering.
Essentially, what you're saying is that this whole hurricane was geoengineered to harness energy to use for part of what happened at 9/11.
Well, maybe not harnessed, but to be utilised. In other words, the energy from the storm system in the form of an electrical or static field, actually, which is, everyone knows that a storm system has electricity associated with it, you know, lightning and etc. And that's what was reported at all three airports around New York on 9/11. Dry thunder. In other words, it wasn't storms and rain, but there was the sound of thunder, which is caused by electrical discharge from a storm system. So I would argue that that's what Hurricane Erin was. It was a geoengineer. Well, it was manipulated storm done with geoengineering technology, which we know then, if you accept that conclusion, that was available to them in 2001, and it was operational then. So that was 14 years ago,
right.
Over 14 years ago now. So, you know, those are my conclusions in general terms, and people can, if they want more specifics, again, please write to me and I can forward the various links and so forth.
Sure, fab. Okay. I mean, it could also be said, just on everything you just said, you could also say, obviously, so that if all that's true and that is the reason for these so-called chemtrails in the sky, they do get the double effect of instilling the fear too, though, for the people that all do believe that we're being slowly poisoned by this. So it's another human consciousness issue too.
That's right. I'm glad that you said that, because that was the thing that I forgot to say, that it works in the same way. You're getting the same sort of trauma-based mind control that was done with 9/11. The alternative knowledge community on the internet is doing that job for,
yeah,
you know,
indeed,
these people who do these
indeed
things. The people, yeah, they end up, and I know they don't mean it. Those people are well-meaning. They're trying to wake people up, but you're instilling more fear. Mm. Based on something you're not totally sure is true. That's the problem. You know, yes, I can see the trails. Yes, I can see the grids. Yes, I don't think they should be there like that. But is it toxic spray? Is it nanochips? You know, is it to do with HAARP?
Yeah.
Do you really know that?
Indeed.
You know?
So for all those out there who don't believe that the truth movement has been sort of instigated and used from the very start, I think you need to take another look at it, guys.
I agree, and keep on reevaluating your own conclusions.
Because we are led by our emotions big time, and that's what they use to a very
yes
large extent.
Okay,
absolutely. Well, I think I'm going to draw it to a close soon, Andrew. It's been fantastic to talk to you, and I do thank you very much, and I hope you'll come back at some point. I'd just like to say, I think we're still very much, and I think this is something some people tend to forget, we're still very much at the start of all of this, and by that I mean at the start of change, and it's very early days, and we've got so much to learn, and I think the most important thing that people need to remember is that we have started, even though it may seem slow sometimes.
Yes, well, I think it's an ongoing process, as you say, yeah, I hope that obviously things will, change, and that we will get these things like free energy in use, and we can use it responsibly and share it with everyone and make the world a better place. You know, that's my ultimate goal in all of this, to have that world available to my children or grandchildren and everyone's children and grandchildren.
Yeah.
That is my goal, and I hope that, you know, we are getting this change in consciousness, but it still remains to be seen, I think.
Indeed. Okay. Well, again, I do admire and respect what you do, Andrew, greatly, and it's been fantastic to listen to your thoughts and opinions on everything. So I'd just like to ask, is there any final message that you'd like to give to people listening? And, of course, if you want to plug anything else too, and any new developments for yourself going on at the moment that you'd like to mention?
Well, I'd just like to thank you very much, Lisa, for what you've been doing. And I know you've been working at this for must be at least a couple of years. So I'd like to thank you for all that ongoing research and effort that you've been making. I don't have anything specific that comes to mind. I do sort of post articles now and again on checktheevidence.com. If you go over to the right hand side on that homepage, you'll see recent postings. You can find stuff there. I do have a little email group as well that I send stuff out to sporadically. I'm doing a talk in Derby on the 27th of October, which is a Tuesday, and I'm doing the next Tuesday actually as we speak.
Indeed,
now,
yeah.
And I'm doing one in Nottingham on the is it the 24th of November or the 25th? I'd have to, but it's on my website anyway.
Okay.
And people will see that there, and and I've got various DVDs which cover some of this on my website, which I sell for 45 pence plus postage, which people can get.
Very reasonable.
Cheap access to. Yep, I try and make it. I don't make any money off this. You know, I work for the OU, so I don't try and make a living off the alternative knowledge stuff, because I don't need to do
sure
that. It's something that, you know, I want to make free and accessible to anybody really who has the time to look at it. So, yeah, just, you know, Keep your BS meters finely tuned. You know, look into people's backgrounds, look into my background, you know, see what you can find out about me. Am I just another talking head, or, you know, is what I'm saying true? You know, you're going to have to check that for yourself, because it's important to do
indeed.
That.
It's very much down to what you do yourself. Don't take anything for granted. But yeah, well, thanks very much, Andrew. Don't go, because we'll have a few small words afterwards. But I'd just like to say, I hope we do it again one day. Good luck with everything that you're doing, and keep up the great work. Yeah.
Thank you. And very much the same to you, Lisa.
Thanks, Andrew.